Welcome to a new edition of the Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino series. On this episode, we talk with physician, author, and professional coach, Deborah E. Blame. She was born in New York and grew up in Long Island and has always had a passion for the humanities. She has degrees in philosophy, comparative religion, and medicine. As an established author, her newest book is called Undue Influences, that continues her campaign against greed and argues for the practice of integrity. As a certified professional coach, master trainer, and certified group leader, she works with clients who are either struggling to navigate the corporate world or those who themselves wish to write and publish. She has a great story. Enjoy this interview.
Hi, Deborah. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for taking a minute out today.
Thanks for inviting me. It was like a surprise because I'm very new to Podmatch. I was like, oh, wow, somebody wants me to come. I don't have to ask.
Thank you. You know, and the one thing that that is so good about doing this interview series. I lost my father in 2008. He grew up in Long Island. He was born in Brooklyn and raised in Long Island. So there's so many connections out east. So where are you from in Long Island?
So I live currently in Melville, which is just on the other side of the Suffolk border. I was born in the city. Of course, you know, for New Yorkers, when you say the city, there's only one city that you're referring to on the whole planet. And then we moved to Freeport when I was five. I graduated high school early because my father decided to move to San Antonio and open a muffler shop. Had he ever done anything with cars before? No, not at all. But that's what we did. And so I went to UT Austin, and then I started a doctoral program back east at Temple University in comparative religion. Kind of a long story how I ended up back in medicine. But I think all roads lead to the same place, and I think I'm kind of doing now what I was always interested in doing but didn't know how to get there at the time.
Yeah. I think to find yourself and what you're really into probably takes time, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, but it also takes courage. You know, I mean, you can know what you want but feel like, you know, forces, especially family forces, are not supportive or actively unsupportive. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, I know that I caved to pressure several times and that didn't really serve me, and I resented it, and I didn't want to do it, but I did, and, you know, and I was raising, I raised my son as a single parent since he was two, and life became about survival for the longest time, and now that he's grown, he's 30 years old, he's off my payroll, he's married, and now it's kind of like, well, what do I want to be when I grow up?
Right.
So now it's my turn.
Speaking of growing up, what did you want to be when you were younger?
So when I was younger, like, you know, I think like in high school, I really wanted to be a forest ranger because I just love being out in nature. I love animals. I just felt connected to the energy of the earth, and I was very active, and, you know, I'm a scuba diver. Well, I was a scuba diver. I went skydiving once. But, you know, I mean, I've been rock climbing and rappelling, and, you know, I wanted that connection with the earth. But I didn't do that because in my family, it was, you're only allowed to be one of three things, a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. I went to college, UT Austin. I majored in what was called the Plan 2 Honors Humanities Program. And I was, you come out with concentrations, like you take their Plan 2 curriculum and then you concentrate. My concentration was in philosophy and also in Hebrew, which is another long story. But so I graduated from there, and I started a doctoral program in comparative religion at Temple University, which is why I said I was coming back east. And I had already been disowned once by my family at the age of 18. But now I was 20, and I went back there for intercession, and my father asked me, he said, what are you going to do with a doctorate in comparative religion? You're a failure, literally said that. And, you know, what did I send you to college for? Which, you know, I sort of prided myself on paying my own way from the time I was a sophomore. I mean, it was easy. UT Austin back in the day, it was $4 a credit, so I could do that. But I wasn't strong enough to stand up and say, no, I'm going to do me. And even though I was already so kind of buffered by what was going on, I decided, okay, so I left and I went back and I said, okay, I'll go to medical school. It never occurred to me that I might not get into medical school, but I went to medical school. But it was, I don't think I ever had that fire for it. Like my son is a resident right now, and he loves what he's doing. I don't think I ever felt that way. I always felt like, I wasn't, you know, like, I hope I get through. I hope I don't flunk out. I hope I don't kill anybody. But I practiced for 33 years. So to my knowledge, I haven't killed anybody. That's a good thing. Medicine has changed. So it used to be a lot easier to be happy in medicine. And now it's become such a profit-driven industry. It's a business. So you used to be able to go into medicine and say, okay, you know, I really want to do this. I want to help people. I want to be the hero, which is kind of what, you know, in a way you are. And I want to really do good for people and connect with people. And I know that along the way, I'll make a decent living and I'll be able to, you know, put my kids through school and have a nice house and whatever. But now it's almost like the people who want to make a lot of money look at healthcare and say, oh, let's use healthcare as our vehicle to make that money. And yeah, we'll be doing something nice along the way, so it'll be cool. The whole priority is different. The whole focus is different. And, you know, what happens to us when we, as physicians or anybody who's working in healthcare, you know, we're just like the pawns in this machine. And the patients are the pawns as well. The patients are the customers by which these people are getting rich. And it so disgusted me that I started writing a book. That was my first book. I wrote it because I wanted, you know, the general population to know what was happening. Why can't you spend more than 3 minutes with your doctor? Why is your doctor staring at this computer screen the whole time? Why is it that you can't get the medicine your doctor wanted you to get? Why, you know, so, and also just the challenges that we go through. That I live on Long Island, which is, you know, if Long Islanders are listening, please forgive, but it's a very entitled, privileged population, and they're very demanding. This is what I want. This is what I want it. And I, you know, and why aren't you taking care of me before that cardiac patient? And we're supposed to always, you know, the customer's always right in the business world. So in the healthcare world, the patient is always right, even if they're asking for something that's inappropriate. So I wrote this book. And I made it sort of like, you know, writing a book is daunting. Like, it's a big project. It's like, oh, my God, how am I going to write? I didn't think of it like that. I just started writing little scenarios, little patient scenarios. So in every patient scenario, of course, the names are changed, the details are changed, but every one of them is based on something that actually happened. And then I started to string them together. And, you know, there were different stories. That, you know, the person I can't, the elderly person who I can't get medication for, or the person who, you know, comes in, they fell on their shoulder 30 minutes ago and demanding an MRI of their shoulder, which is not appropriate. You know, but they were all sort of strung together. And then I would say, well, are you going to make this a fiction or a nonfiction? Well, I couldn't make it a nonfiction because I couldn't call out the organization I was working for. I couldn't, I was afraid of the liability of actually saying these things. So I said, okay, I'll make it a fiction. So when you make something a fiction, you need to have a hero, a villain, a plot. There has to be obstacles. There has to be intrigue. There has to be suspense. There has to be, you know, all these factors that I had never written a book like that before. But I found a mentor who helped me a lot, and I wrote this thriller plot, which was that the Russian oligarchs hacked into our electronic medical records, and they stole a lot of information and used it to extort millions of dollars from patients and politicians, and then they murdered them, well, especially the patients. And, of course, the doctor that you follow through the course of the day through the corporate urgent care becomes a target for the Russians. So that became my first book, and it's people even ask me, like, did this really happen? I'm like, no. Like that story, where was that? Where did that happen? I said, I just made it up. So he's like, but it sounds like it could happen. I was like, well, okay, yeah, that's really good, but I just made it up. So yeah, that was my first book. But I discovered that I love writing fiction. I love creating characters, and the characters start doing things that they do because it's in their character to do them. And then sometimes you get stuck, and it's like, oh, no, the character says, I'm not doing that. I'm doing this because that's what I would do. And like, okay, so what do I do with that? You know, there's always the author joke, you know, don't get an author angry because they'll put you in one of their books and kill you off.
That's right. Well, it's, you know, what's interesting about what you're doing, and when I think about your background is very interesting. You have philosophy and theology and medicine, and it seems like to have an understanding of all of those would make you such a grounded person. And I think about how you've woven these stories together and how COVID kind of was like our society. The medical industry has always been kind of a car teetering on the edge, and COVID tended to kind of throw things over the edge. You know, just the way you're describing how medicine goes. Did you see that being the way when we really got under the magnifying glass, when things were really ramped up, that medicine was starting to capsize because of the place that it was in for so long?
So I think that medicine had already capsized, to be honest. And I think that, you know, when COVID first happened, there was a multitude of different emotions. There was wanting to help. A bunch of people in my age group, I'm 61, or just a little bit older, quit. They didn't want to be on the front lines. I actually went back to work. I had taken 11 months off. I was writing my second book at the time, which had nothing to do with medicine. And all I could think of was, what will my grandchildren say to me? You know, well, what will I say to my grandchildren when they ask me, what were you doing during the pandemic of 2020, Grandma? And I would be saying, oh, well, I was sitting out on the sides. And I was embarrassed by that. I was like, you know, people need me right now. And so I went back and still working part-time. I'm kind of over that whole guilt thing now. I'm ready to quit. But yeah. It's, you know, at that time, you know, it turned out to be, for what I was doing in urgent care, more of a just test and go kind of thing, but a lot of risk, you know, a lot of risk. And it's just, I mean, it's kind of gotten worse. I mean, people who were working in the hospitals, the horror stories that I heard, and the, you know, and even so, you know, back to the issues with the medical industry, you know, I had colleagues who told me, they were told they're not allowed to wear a mask in the beginning because you'll scare the patients. And they were, and then wow. Someone even had their mask ripped off their face by someone, like one of the, you know, CEOs or something. And said, you're not allowed to wear that. And it's like, you know, it was just, it really, it accelerated that, that denigration of the healthcare worker in favor of the business model and the people who wanted to make money. So yes, you're right. So I think it was already capsized, but it just like started throwing extra water in the boat. There's so many people have left the healthcare field, nurses, doctors.
So many levels of our, you know, service-driven society that have been so maxed out. And I don't think the people at the top have been cognizant. It's like business as usual, and mental health is so key to all of this. And I don't know that that's been woven in. And then we aren't even factoring in the kids, like their separation from the couple of years, them getting back in. You know, I'm going to be 50 this year. And at our age, our collective age, you know, we've lived most of our lives. We haven't seen a pandemic. These kids, this is a new narrative for their story, you know, and they're trying to deal with it. So we haven't even factored in what that's going to do and the regression that goes into their development as well.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, what you're saying before about, I think one of the issues that we're seeing in terms of mental health, and I actually wrote a thing about this, is that the most debilitating disease, I think, is greed. It's the addiction to more. I need more. Mm-hmm. You know, and the CEOs are contributing, you know, and it's really, I think it's like an illness. Like, how much do you need?
Yep.
They just want more and more and more, and they're literally raping the population under them. And I'm not really sure they even understand why they need to have more. And this is, you know, so my second book is about greed, and it's about the extremism that we've been experiencing in this country and the way it's fractured our communities and how that's happened and how we're being manipulated for someone else's agenda. You know, we're following these party lines without thinking them through, and we're just playing into the hands of the two people who are basically playing chess with us, you know, or two parties that are playing chess with us. And it's, you know, I would just love to see us be able to stop and think about, why do we have the opinion we have, and where are we going with this, and why do we care, and do we really care? You know, like, my whole reason for writing fiction is that, especially 4 years ago, there were too many platforms to jump on. It was, everything was a crisis. Everything was let's march for this. Let's sign petitions for this. It was exhausting. I don't know about you, but I was just exhausted by listening to the news. I would have to turn it off, you know, every once in a while for a few days. And so by writing fiction, I felt like I wasn't shoving anything in somebody's face. I was like trying to entertain them, and then they can think about this at their leisure or not think about it at all. They can just maybe enjoy the story. But hopefully people will think about these issues that I'm trying to bring up in a way that's not threatening. And I love writing the fiction. So I, you know, that's it for me. I'm just finishing. Just yesterday I sent my third manuscript off to my beta readers, and this one is a dystopian fiction, and basically the message is that humanity is going to go extinct unless we learn to be better humans. And so that's kind of what the book is, and how it's going to be called some variation of Pillars of Salt. But it's not yet. That's coming. I'm hoping to get it out by the end of August. It's
funny you put that out now, because I keep thinking in this post-COVID period, there's so many ways that we have been irrevocably changed as human beings that it almost feels like sometimes it is a dystopian society. I mean, especially with, we're coming out of a pandemic, and then all of a sudden we have to start thinking about World War III and rationing and inflation, and all of these businesses said, well, you know, we made it through COVID, but now they're gouging all of us. You know, there's so many levels of this that is highly unfortunate. But I do want to say real quick before you went on, I found it interesting when you said that you wanted to be a forest ranger. I always remember that stand-up bit that Dennis Miller did, and he was like, where do you go to get away from it all when you're a forest ranger? And I always remember that line.
That's funny.
It's such a great line. Yeah. But yeah,
you go to the
no,
city.
So
you go to the city and
yeah.
see
that's right. You go into the urban circus for sure. You just kind of flip the tables. But, you know, so I'm curious. I've always been curious about this. I grew up in a little town called Liberty, Missouri. It's outside of Kansas City. And it's rather affluent. It's like you explain Long Island is. There's a lot of entitlement, money, and things that go into it. And I always find it, because a lot of it, because I came from the other side, I always grew up with no money. So whenever I would see these kids that would be highly motivated, and they would be like, my parents are just all over me, and if I don't do this, it's going to be a problem. So I find it interesting with you. You're so highly driven, so well decorated in education. Did you, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but did you kind of bury the hatchet with your family now that your son's grown and you kind of, you know, wisdom tends to kind of wash all that away?
Well, I would love to, but my family is all gone. So my brother died 22 years ago, and my parents died 25 and 13 years ago. So,
okay.
I think that the hardest thing about grieving is when you have regrets. You know, there's just things that I wish we could have settled. My mother did apologize to me, like basically from her deathbed. She just said, "I'm sorry," and I said, "What for?" And she said, "For everything." It helped. But I didn't come from money. I came from the illusion of money. My parents never wanted anyone, including us, to know that they really didn't have that much. They lived above their means, and maybe that's one of the reasons they pushed me the way they did. When I was growing up, I didn't have support from them, not only financially, but not even emotionally. And I was, like I said, single parent from the age of two, from my son's age of two. So it was tough. It was... I think about them a lot more now than I used to, and you know, I don't know. I talk to them. my brother, I miss so much. You know, I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah,
I mean, if they were
totally
alive
does.
Today, yeah. I mean, I would like to think that we would be able to, you know, sort of. I mean, I think that, you know, when each of them went, my father, I was called at work and said, you know, if you want to see your father alive, you better get home. And I got home and I was able to spend a little time with him, and he died like an hour later. He waited for me. I know he did.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Well, no, I appreciate you being candid about that. You know, I mean, I know my dad being a New Yorker and growing up, you know, the way he did, he would always be like, you got to go to college. You know, he don't be like, he was a car salesman. He was like, you know, I just want you to be better educated. And I think that's what successive generations always want for their kids, something better than what they went through. And, you know, and I guess that leads into my next question to you is, with that in mind, who's been a hero for you?
People who followed their own heart. You know, like I so wish that Michael Crichton was still alive and that he would, you know, grant me, you know, a relative no name, an interview with him, because He got a medical degree from Harvard, and he never practiced medicine. He went off and he wrote and made films and, you know, made statements through his fiction about, like, warnings about what could happen to society and be careful. And I would love to be able to talk to him, because he did his own thing. You know, he followed the, I don't know why he became a doctor initially, but then he put in all that time, all that effort, probably all that money, and said, you know what, I don't want to do this. And I kind of wish that I had had the guts to do that, you know, decades ago, instead of, you know, but I feel like all roads lead to the same place. Here I am, I'm trying to make, you know, to say in my books, you know, give my perspective. But I think that he's one of them.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've always been fascinated by that, too. In fact, whenever I realized that that was what he did, I was like, there's no way. But, you know, a lot of the angles of the way he wrote were totally entrenched in that. You know, I'm curious, based on your upbringing, what was your overall philosophy with your son? How did you revise the way that you were going to be with your own child based on your upbringing?
Well, one of the things that was really important to me was to let him be who he wanted to be. Because I was always told what I was going to think, what I was going to feel, what I was going to want, and what I was going to do. And if I didn't follow all that, I wasn't part of the family. And, you know, at some point I finally had to choose between being part of the family or having a piece of myself. And I chose myself. But with my son, I always tried to just let him decide. Like, I never tried to encourage him or discourage him from any career that he wanted. I remember when he was in like sixth grade or something, and he was choosing the language he wanted to take, you know, in school, and he wanted to take French. And my son was brilliant, but at that time spelling wasn't really his, you know, his forte. So I remember I said, French, you want to take French? I said, well, okay. I said, but, you know, just so that, you know, just consider that French isn't used as much in this country as, like, say, Spanish. And French is very different in terms of, you know, how it's spelled, and that's not really your biggest strength. And there's nobody in the house that can help, or none of your friends or relatives can help you with French. Whereas, you know, I could probably help you with Spanish, you know. So just think about that. Nope, I want to do French. I said, fine, do the French. 3 weeks into his semester with French, Mom, why did you let me take French? Like, you realize I couldn't win that one, right? If I hadn't let you take French, you would have been always like, I wanted to take French and you didn't let me. So, and then when he was trying to decide what he wanted to be when he grew up, he's a very, very talented musician, and he wanted to do music, and I wanted to encourage him to do music, but he wanted to get a Bachelor of Music. And I said, I want you to do that. I want you to get a Bachelor of Arts and major in music at a very good school where you can make connections, because just in case you change your mind, what else are you going to do with a Bachelor of Music if you decide you don't want to do music? And, you know, and then he told me he wants to be a music professor at a university. I said, you can't do that. He just looked at me like it was the first time I ever said you can't do that. I said, you can do that, but you have to do something else in addition. You're going to have to get in, you're going to have to, you know, make some connections and get involved in the commercial world of music, because a professor's salary is not going to support you in the manner to which you would like to be accustomed. And he was like, oh. So, but he did. He went off to Brandeis and majored in music. And then when he was in the middle of his sophomore year, he said, Mom, every time I walk in the science building, I want to be a science major. And he ended up pre-med, and now, and he went to medical school. But when he was in 10th grade, I said, listen, I want you to do this summer, if you're interested, you know, do one day a week with one of my colleagues who's an orthopedist. Just see what it's like. And I wanted him to have the opportunity to see it and know that he was turning it down because he really didn't want that, and not look back and say, wow, I wish I had done that. So he did the summer, and then he said, Mom, that was awesome, but I don't want to be a doctor. And I said, that's fine. I don't, you know, that's what it was for. And, I always tried to do that. I always tried to let him have whatever feelings he had and validate them. That doesn't mean you can have the behavior that he wants to go along with the feelings. But, you know, I tried to just let him be himself. It was really important to me.
I've discovered as a parent myself that the only thing that I'm really truly, you know, in control of is the love that I give, you know, and I think, especially over this COVID time, there's so many things that have been rearranged. So the one thing, too, that I want to ask you is that when you were talking about him taking French and then he realized it later, you know, at your age right now, if you have a dream tonight, you've run into like your 20-year-old version in your dream, and you can give that version of you one piece of advice based on the wisdom you've gained over all these years, what would you tell your younger version?
I'd say don't be afraid. Go for what your heart wants. Go for what you really want, and you'll find a way to do it. That's what I would say, because, you know, I got scared. I got scared too much because I felt alone, and I felt like I couldn't handle it by myself, and I went with what was safe. And it was not like I had a bad life or anything. I just, like, you know, I think that I would have been more fulfilled if I had started the process earlier.
So I was going to ask this up front, but it's probably good now that we have context at this point. If someone comes up to you and they say, what do you do for a living? What is it that you do? How would you describe what you do?
Well, the first thing I identify with is that I'm an author now. And it's interesting because, so I'm also a coach, by the way. I certified as a coach when I had taken some time off from medicine. And one of the things that I talk to other doctors about is we have a tendency to identify by our profession. This is who I am. I'm a doctor. And one of the things that I try to gently teach them is there's so much more that we all are. So I'm a doctor. I'm considering myself now a retired doctor, which I like the sound of that much better. I'm a mother. I'm a woman. I'm Jewish. But I'm an author in terms of what I do. I'm a coach. But I think the most important thing that I do right now is that I write, and I try to send a message in my writing in a way that's, you know, just entertaining, you know, that's just fun to read. So, yeah, but I can't give you one word to say who I am. And I think that's the whole point, is that we're so much more than one or two words that describe where we fit in society.
Well, and that's my point. There's so much that's going on with you. I just wanted to hear from you. You know, you did mention Michael Crichton, who's not around anymore, but I'm curious, anybody that's alive on this planet right now, if you could get transported there and you could meet and talk to him for a little bit, who that's alive right now would you love to meet and or talk to?
Whoever would be the executive producer to create to move my books into movies. I can't, anybody who's alive right now. I don't know. I think I pretty much, the people that are alive, I think I've at least reached out to. I'd love to talk to Bill Clinton and say, like, why did you let them take your personal life and throw it up in your face? You know, like, I think what he did was, you know, it was disgusting, but it wasn't my business. I shouldn't have known about it. It didn't matter. You know, I thought he was a great president, but who needed that stuff about, you know, his indiscretion? I think most of the people said. No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it's so interesting you say that. That was one of the reasons why I came up with this question. I was thinking myself, and, you know, I would love, of all people, to meet him, and I would just love to be in that aura. I saw him speak one time. I think it was back in 06. He spoke at the Truman Library here in Independence, which is a suburb of Kansas City. And when he came through that door, there's a magic. There's an aura that's around him that's, like, not of this planet. Like, not that what typical people can see. So I think, yeah, I think he would be a fascinating person, and just the stories and his delivery and who he is. So anyway, I concur. I think Bill would be wonderful.
Good. Cool.
For sure. So let's say, and you may have kind of already answered this, but let's say we catch up 10 years from now. And I ask you first and foremost, Deborah, what's going on? What are you happy to see that's happened in your life? I think it might have to do with an executive producer, but I'm going to let you answer it.
I would love to be able to say that I have doubled my previous full-time clinical income just on my books and book-related activities like movies, speaking engagements, and that I've got, an entire library out there, and that I can just spend my leisure time not worrying so much, just enjoying my friends, my grandchildren, and helping other people to get where they want to go, you know, just giving people a leg up.
So what book did you read growing up that you always go back to? Probably more of a work of fiction, obviously, because that's what you do.
Yeah.
Is there a book that you absolutely love that created a flashpoint or something special in you?
Well, there's two things. So there was a series of books, the Darkover series, which was by Marion Zimmer Bradley. And I probably read those books, each of them, you know, several times when I was, and she was writing them from like the time I was about 11 to maybe into my mid-20s. So that was really good because like it was a good period for me to keep reading them. And what I really liked about that was it was so interesting that she created another world and a whole different kind of society and gave the reasons how that society developed the way that it did. And there was values in there. There was the whole idea of honor and integrity. And it really resonated with me. In fact, I broke up with a boyfriend when I was in medical school because I was reading this book and I knew he wanted to get married. And I knew that I was just not going to marry this guy. I mean, I really loved him, but he wasn't my future. And I'm reading this book and it's all about the honor and being honorable. And I was like, I can't leave him. I can't keep him hanging like this. And I ended up breaking up with him, not because I didn't want to see him anymore, but I was like, you know, I just felt like, yeah, no, we have to be good people. We have to do the right thing. And because I knew that's what he wanted. He didn't just want to hang out for a year or so. So I think those books I definitely read over and over again. But I also, there was a book as a kid that I read called The Greyhound by Helen Griffith. And I read that several times, and I don't know if I could read it again now because I know it would make me cry again, and I just like I'm just not ready to get my heart wrenched like that. It was about a boy maybe 10 or 11 years old in London, and he's a lonely kid, and he ends up with this greyhound. This older guy has to give up his. He was walking him, and he has to give up the greyhound. And so this boy buys the greyhound, but in order to do that, he has to borrow the money from, you know, the neighborhood riffraff, and then they want him to pay it back. But it was, I think it was just the, you know, the animal part, the connective part, just that that tear at the heartstrings kind of thing, that if it was just one book, then I would go with that. But if it was like the series, I mean, I read over and over and over again into my more adult life too.
So everyone has a perception of you, your family, your friends, all of your fans that buy your books, colleagues. But you live your life. Who do you think you are?
I'm just trying to make it in this world like everybody else. I think that we're all just trying to find our way. And I feel like I can see things. Like I see the forest before the trees very frequently, and I feel like I can see, you know, and I try to express that. But I'm very connected with nature. Apparently I rescue cats. I love animals. I can't stand to see any little creature suffer. Who am I? I mean, you know, people look at me and say I'm educated and all this, and I guess I don't really experience myself that way. I'm just me, you know. I don't feel anymore like I have to, like when I was in my 20s, I wanted to change the world, and I sort of wisdom has, you know, come in, and I don't think I can change the world, but you know, my job is to put my message out there, and if it takes, great, and if it doesn't, I did my part. There's a thing in Talmud that says, it is not your job to fix the world, but neither are you entitled to not, you know, put in some repair work or something. It's something like that. It's not those words, but like we're obligated to do our part, but we're not obligated to make it, to be successful in the whole project.
So if anybody wants to get your books, learn about you, anything related to you and your life and anything around that, where should they go? Where's the best place for them to visit?
So they could go to my website, deborahblaine.com. If they want either of my books that are out, they can go to Deborah Blaine on Amazon. But on my website, they can look at the coaching. You know, they can sign up for coaching or for a free consultation. They can look at the books. You know, both of them, they can look at my particular philosophies. I have a little blog, and yeah, so that would be the most comprehensive place to go would be deborahblaine.com.
Wonderful. Deborah, it was great to get to know you. Thank you for opening up. I appreciate it. Good luck with the dystopian novel and everything that comes your way.
Well, thank you so much, Joe. You're just such a good time talking to you. You're just so easygoing, and you're a great guy, and I love your program, so thank you.
Thanks for listening and tuning into another Famous Interview with Joe Domino, where we cover the world of art, literature, medicine, and music around the globe. Most of the music on these episodes comes from Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. And if you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store. You can visit us at the Neon Jazz YouTube channel. And for everything Joe Domino related, go to JoeDomino.com. And there you can contribute to the cause via PayPal or Patreon. Until next time.